You know, when we were told, as I said, we were told around February, March that she had this terrible tumour that was huge and had spread elsewhere. I remember my brother-in-law, who happens to be a doctor, not an oncologist, said, I think with my medical experience, she'll be gone before Christmas. And I was in disbelief and I said, Christmas of what year? And he said, Christmas of this year.
Kia ora, and welcome to The C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer, the podcast for cancery people who want real conversations about cancer. I'm your host, Helen King. Subscribe on iTunes or follow me on Spotify, where you can catch up with all my previous episodes. Earlier this week, I did a live stream on Facebook with sleep and cancer coach Anitha Ranganathan. If you didn't catch it, head over to my page and watch the video. I found it so interesting talking to Anitha because sleep is something I have struggled with well before cancer, and post-cancer treatment, it has been much worse. I'll put Anitha's details in the show notes because I think trouble with sleep is something that is quite a big problem for people that have been through cancer. If you caught last week's episode, you'll know that for the next few weeks, I'll be talking to people about how cancer has impacted their family and whānau. Cancer is so prevalent, but we don't often talk about what the lasting impact can have, especially within a family or wider community. So I'm hoping that this might open up conversations for people, or maybe help others understand the lasting effect that cancer has. Before I play today's episode, I just want to make a little note about if you hear any strange noises in the background. Basically, there are parts of this episode that could end up in a bloopers reel at the end of the year. This interview was done during the most recent lockdown here in Auckland, and I was at home with my two dogs, who are both quite young, so they love to play, but they also like to be wherever I am. So when Andrew came onto the Zoom call, he came on to me shouting, "Get out, get out," not to him, but to my puppy that had discovered where the cat was in the room. And then during the interview, you can probably hear the dogs play fighting at some point. Yeah. And if there was a video to this, you would probably see me throwing a water bottle across the room to try and get the pup to get away from the cat. So what do they say? Never work with children and animals, maybe never record podcasts with young dogs in their room. In 1950, a teenage Shirley Young moved from China and made New Zealand her home. She was living in New Plymouth when a suitor from Wellington came courting. They would get married and have five children. One of those children would grow up to be the CEO of the Cancer Society for Auckland and Northland. Andrew Young remembers his mum as small but fierce and never imagined she would die from cancer. We chatted over Zoom about how his mum's death has impacted him.
My best friend at university, one of my closest friends, died of stomach cancer after graduation. And that's sort of in the Chinese whānau. We're one village, very closely connected. But more pertinent to me was my mother's death to cancer in 2007 to lung cancer. Boy, that affected me and my siblings really hard. I think when you lose your mum, doesn't matter who you are, when you lose your mum, it's your mum. I know that affects everyone, no matter what nationality. But that's been the hardest for me, I have to say, Helen, losing my mum.
There is something really, I don't know if primal is the right word, but I think I've mentioned to you before that my mum had cancer coming up to 14, 15 years ago now. And I remember when she they turned up on my doorstep to tell me, which is just typical of our family. And I remember spending the next day in bed just crying. Like, I could not stop because there was just this feeling. It was almost this childlike thing of, oh my God, mum might die. And I don't know, I don't have the right words for it, but it did feel something very, very deep. Was that similar to you? I mean, can you remember that moment when you found out?
Totally, yeah. It was, I think your word primal is spot on. It felt somewhere right in your your inner core, your heart. I won't forget it when we found out that mum had a huge tumour in her lungs. Yeah, it's almost like I don't think anyone spends a lot of time thinking about losing your parents until you have to think about it. You just kind of think your parents are always going to be there for you, because for me, and I'm sure for many people out there, your parents are your guiding light. They're the ones who gave you life. They're the ones who nurture and, you know, correct you and discipline you and lecture you, but they always have the best intentions, or mine did. And so my mum, I always thought she was infallible. She was tiny and really petite, but boy, she was tough. And she wore the pants in our family, you know, and us five kids, you know, we grew up in poverty. My parents were immigrants and came over, met here, got married and had nothing and had a little fruit shop. But they taught us, you know, under their rules, we were going to go to university and get educated and get real jobs and be professionals and not have to bag spuds and things. So my mum was such a guiding light, such a force to reckon with. And so I didn't think anything was going to take mum out, let alone bloody cancer. Hate cancer, as you know. But yeah, so that primal is a great sort of term for that. Yeah, I thought it was kind of really tragic in the way that my mum was taken really quickly. I know your mum's had a good outcome. My mum had a terrible outcome. And, you know, when we were told, as I said, we were told around February, March, that she had this terrible tumour that was huge and had spread elsewhere. I remember my brother-in-law, who happens to be a doctor, not an oncologist, said, "I think with my medical experience, she'll be gone before Christmas." And I was in disbelief, and I said, "Christmas of what year?" And he said, "Christmas of this year." Now, I said to him, "That's ridiculous. There's no way mum's going to go within a few months." Now, not only did we not have till Christmas, she was gone within 2 months of that date. So it was fast and it was brutal and it was cruel. So, yeah, I'll never forget that. But also the sort of ethnic, the way mum was and her ethnic beliefs also made it quite difficult for us to deal with us. We were in shock and we didn't have a lot of time with mum, but she didn't want anyone to know, because in old-fashioned Chinese, you know, you save face and you don't trouble people, you don't burden people with your worries and your troubles, and if you've got cancer, well, you're going to die, you know, so why even bother? And mum also had this denial thing: if you say it, it might come true. So, you know, we weren't even allowed to really talk about the cancer. So she didn't want us to share with her friends. She didn't want to share with her friends. She didn't want to tell her siblings. She didn't want to burden people with her troubles and her worries. She just thought when it came to the end, she would just want to slip away quietly. And I just thought it was so, for mum being such a strong woman, it was so defeatist. And we wanted her to stand up and fight and actually tell people and be honoured for her amazing life and everything she had done. Yeah.
I feel quite emotional as you're telling me it, because I can just see her in my mind's eye, and I feel like there are people in, you know, some of our older generations that have actually just been so harmed by that stoicness, you know, and I sort of understand that, heard it from a lot of women about, you know, they leave things for longer because they don't want, you know, they're so used to looking after everyone else.
Yes.
That they don't sort of think about looking after themselves. And I was curious when you said that mum had lung cancer, was that a secondary cancer? Had it started elsewhere?
Well, I have an ongoing issue with one day I'm going to have to get over this or not, with the care she got from her GP. And again, being a staunch, old-fashioned Chinese person, you never question your doctor, Helen. You know, a GP is up there on a pedestal, let alone your oncologist or what have you. So we as a family, as siblings and educated kids, thanks to mum's harassing and nagging, we all went through university, and yeah, there are doctors and lawyers and all sorts of people in my family. We did our own research, and we don't think, mum had a persistent cough and had had it for years, and we kept saying, go to the doctor, get it checked out. Now the GP always sort of wrote it off and said, no, she's just tired, or she's whatever, she just needs she'll be fine. So mum always said, well, the doctor said it's fine. Now, I think the primary thing was her lungs, so that's where it started from, but then it turned into secondaries elsewhere, and it was too far gone. Now, we think if mum had questioned more, maybe if she had better language skills in English, and that's another barrier often with ethnic minorities, that I don't think she could speak fully and frankly to her GP, even if she had the wherewithal to question her GP or to push a bit harder. So there was a language barrier, and because he was a pillar of society, she didn't push it. She just, for years, accepted that he said the cough was okay. When we found out it was lung cancer, we were livid because we thought that he should have diagnosed or got onto it earlier. And she was really healthy. She didn't smoke. She was a pocket rocket. She was really active. Yeah, and ironically, was really big on health and well-being and eating really well, you know, diet, stopped smoking. She had secondary smoke through my father, who smoked a lot, and she would always tell him to stop smoking because it was really bad for the family. Again, ironic, Dad didn't die of lung cancer. He died of a stroke, and Mum died of lung cancer, being a real champion for health and well-being. So, yeah, there is a lot kind of wrapped in there as to how it all came to be and Mum's quick demise. But, yeah, we still think there may be questions to answer there, but that's for another day.
I'm always struck by the fact that there's actually no fairness in cancer. It just, there isn't. There's, it doesn't, because anyone can get it. And, you know, I interviewed a fabulous scientist recently who basically said, you know, if you have cells that can multiply, you can get cancer. Sometimes there is no rhyme or reason for this. And I think that can be really, really challenging to get your head around, you know, if your mother has been, you know, hardworking and looked after herself and, you know, pestered her husband to stop smoking. It must have been very difficult to kind of process that this is what had happened.
Yeah, look, it has been for us, and it seems terribly unfair, but we see unfairness every day. And as you know, I work here at the Cancer Society. I see gross unfairness every day. I see beautiful people who have looked after themselves. You know, and you see in the news, there are people who have smoked and drunk every day of their lives, and they get a telegram from the Queen and they're 120. And you think, well, look, good on you, but we all have bodies with cells that divide, and you're quite right. We are all potentially susceptible to cancer. We can try and do things, and at the Cancer Society, we ask people to stop smoking, to have a really good, nutritious, healthy diet, to exercise regularly, and to stay out of the sun. But, you know, with all the good intent, people who follow all of that advice, some of them will still get cancer. That's a tragedy. And, yeah, for Mama, it did seem totally unfair.
I'm really intrigued as well when we, you know, our older generation, you know, bring with them some of their complexities, whether it's that they don't talk about things or they have, coming from a different country, they've brought their upbringing and sort of have entered this world where they're sort of having to straddle both. And I think about the next generation where you've probably had to straddle both too, to a degree. Has that changed within your siblings of talking about things after watching what Mum went through?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you raise a really good point. So, yeah, we do straddle. And it is hard sometimes because we've been taught by our parents to be in a certain way. And those formative years, you know, those brain connections that we make when we're younger, they hold fast. So sometimes I sort of think, oh, I can't say that because Mum and Dad wouldn't want me to. It's not proper. To be Chinese, you know, you hold it within yourself. I'm not going to burden anyone. I'm going to keep quiet. But then my inner DNA, having had the benefit of a Western education and being, you know, me and my siblings are very highly educated, we've been told through school and through debating teams and through university to blimmin' speak out and just have your voice and be strong and be proud. So there's this constant dilemma being what I call a banana, sort of, you know, white on the inside and yellow on the outside. So I look Chinese, but I have a very Western mindset, yet I was brought up in my formative years by very traditional Chinese immigrants, very hardworking and very disciplined and very stoic in many ways. So it's a constant dilemma. And where this, I think, relates to healthcare is, I think, you know, to your point, I think my siblings and I would be very forthright with our health specialists. So if I had a GP, if I had a persistent cough for years, my GP was saying, oh, Andrew, it's nothing, I would A, ask for a second opinion, or more likely, because I do go through GPs from time to time, if they don't actually meet my standards and if they don't have a holistic view of my healthcare, and if they, as one GP, keep just prescribing me antibiotics, you know, within 5 seconds of me going in, I fired him and went to a different GP who gave me the care that I expect and that I pay for. So I'm very different to my mum and dad in that they would never have done that. They would have been horrified. But my siblings would be proud of me because many of them are in the health system and they say, if you're not getting care that you expect, then move on and, you know, go to someone else, get a second opinion, question and ask questions yourself. So I think we are certainly now, and the way we raise our kids now is to be forthright and to question if you need to, because we've seen the what can happen if you don't question, and it's heartbreaking, you know, and that was my mum's story. So we don't want that to happen to anyone else.
It's really difficult when you know that the health system has potentially failed someone, and I feel like that idea of not being able to question doctors is a huge barrier for a lot of people. And I know for me, I had that privilege of being, you know, a middle-class Pākehā woman with education. And so, you know, you are so vulnerable when you have something like cancer that it is very difficult sometimes to challenge your doctors. But if you have layers of other things going on there, whether it's inequality or racism or poverty or anything like that, you can just see how people get missed and slip through. And then I imagine that's what you guys see. You know, you see that end product.
Yeah, and I guess with my Cancer Society head on, we, like, you know, many aspects of government and DHBs have made Māori equity a sharp focus of ours, because Māori die in huge numbers and we need to do better as a country. And we know from our patients and whānau, especially those who come from the far north and live in poverty and generally don't have a high education and don't communicate potentially well with their healthcare providers and their specialists, a cancer diagnosis for many Māori is a death sentence, and that's how they see it. They don't see that you can turn it around and the diagnosis could mean that you go through a cancer journey, but you're going to get through it and be a cancer survivor for decades beyond that. And that reality came harshly down to us at Waitangi when we met some whānau up north, and they talked about, this woman talked about her husband who was diagnosed with cancer, and he went home and took his life that afternoon. Now, in his mind, cancer equaled death. There was no point because all his ancestors had died of cancer. Everyone in his social community circle had died of cancer. So he saw no way out, and he thought, why put myself and my family through terrible, you know, cancer symptoms and potential treatments which won't go anywhere? And to me, that's heartbreaking, that he felt he had no other choice but to take his life there and then. We need to do better. And that's in the Māori culture. So, you know, today we've talked about my mum's Chinese culture and reluctance, but it's certainly not just within Chinese. It's Māori and many other ethnicities as well. And Pākehā too. There are some who would feel that cancer is the end, and it need not be by any stretch of the imagination.
It's such a good point. And I mean, you do instantly think you're going to die when you're being diagnosed with cancer. I know that sounds really awful, but it does go through your head, because cancer is the boogeyman. And I think that, so many people know an individual, whether it's a family member, a friend, extended community, that have died from cancer. And so I think that is one of the challenges of getting people in and to get checked. Because I know, for instance, you know, people might leave a lump for ages. And if I had done that, I would not have survived, because it was so rapidly growing. I mean, it had made its way into my lymph nodes very quickly. So, that is such a challenge to, I guess, help people understand that cancer is so brutal, but it can be treated. And having a curative treatment program, you know, it's not pleasant, but it's
well, I'd say you have to give treatment a go. You have to try. And obviously no one can guarantee that there'll be life at the end of that. But if you don't try, there is no hope. And I think, you know, going back to your reaction to when your mum told you she had cancer and you cried, you weren't crying because you were thinking, oh, yay, mum's got cancer and she's going to live and she's going to have decades of life. You cried because the human mind, I think, naturally goes to the worst possible outcome with the horrible C word. That's what it instills, absolute utter fear in most of us. And that's why you cried. That's why we cried when we found out our mum had cancer. Yeah.
It's so interesting because this just came to mind, and I don't think I've ever told anyone this, but I am not a, I'm not a religious person. We weren't raised with any sort of religion. And when mum was diagnosed, I don't know what must have been for work. I was down in Christchurch and I went into the cathedral and there was a prayer board. You could put a prayer or a wish, and I put, please make sure mum stays alive long enough so she sees grandchildren. I just sort of think that's, yeah, you do, it's fear, and it kind of, you want to do anything, even if it's sort of outside of what you might normally do.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. See where that drove you, Helen? It drove you to, you know, spirituality and God. And God might have thought, well, you've never talked to me before, but...
What are you doing in here?
Yeah, that's right. Whereas my mother was a regular churchgoer, and, you know, so we were hoping too that there would be some sort of
that
salvation.
Might have put, yeah.
Some input. And maybe there was, maybe, you know, who knows. But I just hope mum's in a really good place now and she's happy and warm and not worrying about us, us naughty kids.
And I imagine or I assume that your experience with your friends that you mentioned before and your mum really influenced into the work you do now.
In a huge way, yeah. When I was tapped on the shoulder to consider being the CEO of the Cancer Society up here in Auckland, Northland, you know, I was in a job that I loved. I was in a health-facing role and hopefully helping, you know, hundreds and thousands of people, and loved my work and was great. But when that recruitment person rang me and said, oh, look, we've got this job we want you to look at, I sort of just off the cuff said, because you get these calls from time to time, I said, no, thanks, I'm in a great job, love what I do, helping lots of people. And then she said, it's for the Cancer Society. And I just stopped and went, how could you say that? And she said, what? And I said, you just said the magic words, Cancer Society. And I was about to tell you no and hang up, but I am really keen to hear what you've got to say. And she asked why, and I said, because the Cancer Society was so amazing to my mother. Before she died, there was a short time, but, yeah, it was the Cancer Society that wrapped its arms around my mum, and especially those amazing volunteer drivers who took mum to and from hospital to drain her lungs when she couldn't breathe, you know, to give her a bit more life. They were amazing. So, yeah, I feel so indebted to the Cancer Society, and I am so incredibly proud to work here that they chose to tap my little shoulders to say, would I consider working here? Yeah, without knowing my history. But I guess it emphasises the fact that, as you say, cancer's not discerning. It affects everyone, and that manifests itself in strange ways. And we have so many donors and volunteers at the Cancer Society who say they do their stuff for us, their thing for us, and they give their support to us because their family's been affected by cancer, because they've been touched by the Cancer Society. So, I'm not alone in feeling a deep regard for the Cancer Society and what I do, because of a very, very real personal experience.
It's so true, isn't it? Because I had a fantastic experience with the Cancer Society, and I think I've talked to you before about the wonderful Bella, my cancer nurse. I will always put my hand up to, you know, shake the bucket to out in the public, even though I'm quite a shy person and don't, you know, it's not my natural sort of thing to be, you know, talking to strangers and that sort of thing. But you really, really develop, I guess, a connection, you know. It sort of bonds you, I think, when someone has been there in your, you know, most vulnerable moment.
You're so not alone. I mean, I've had so many of our wonderful street collectors, you know, across the country. We have over 12,000 that collect for Daffodil Day in August, when we're allowed to collect, when COVID's not lurking its ugly head, the other awful C word. Mm. So when COVID allows us to collect, there's so many street collectors who say, I would never do this. I'd never have the guts to stand out there and to sort of, you know, not that we encourage them to approach people, but just stand in public with a bucket that says Cancer Society, because that in itself can, for some people, make them feel vulnerable or make them remember about their own cancer experience, because a lot of our volunteers have gone through their own cancer experience. And so I do know exactly what you're talking about. People feel vulnerable, but then they feel overwhelmingly proud because they want to support and they want to give back, which is lovely. And then, you know, speaking of COVID this week, again, we at the moment in Auckland, we're in level 3 lockdown again, which means that cancer patients still need to get to hospital and our volunteer drivers are needed more than ever. But we have a number of vulnerable volunteer drivers who can't drive and don't feel safe driving in this environment. So others have stepped up, and the other day a man said, I will do as many drives today as you physically need me to do. And he did, I think, around circuit of 200 to 300 Ks in his car, because he was just constantly driving patients until we had no more patients to bring to hospital. And he could have stayed home and not bothered coming in, but he just felt that huge sense of duty. And so my heart goes out to everyone that can give anything to us.
I want to end on something, because I know you've spoken about your mum in terms of how you remember her as having cancer and, I guess, growing up. But I would love to know, what is one of your favourite memories of your mum? What makes you smile when you think of your mum?
Well, we've had a glorious summer up here. I've started making scotched eggs, boiled eggs wrapped in the sausage meat and deep fried. So not necessarily living to the values of the Cancer Society diet,
but delicious.
Everything in moderation and delicious, so delicious. What's deep fried that's not delicious, tell me. But we have it with copious amounts of salad and lettuce and tomatoes and everything. But scotch eggs remind me of my mother, because she loved, the kitchen was her place, and she loved to show love through her food, and feeding 5 kids, often on a really low income, was hard for mum, but she always put her heart and soul into her food and made sure we were well nourished. And scotch eggs were such a treat and something that mum could probably afford to make for picnics that we would have from time to time. So I've been making scotch eggs for my family, and whether my kids love them or not, I think for the sake of my memory of my mum, they go, yum, Dad, this is so good. And paw-paw, which is the Chinese word for grandmother, would be really proud of you. And that means so much to me. So I sort of eat and I cry and I eat and I smile, because I remember my mum, and through my terrible cooking skills, that's my way of showing love to my family. So I'm kind of passing that on, and I will always remember my mum and picnics and scotch eggs and sunniness and happiness. Yeah, I love my mum.
I really love that. I think, cooking for people is such a loving and nourishing act, even if, you know, I'm the same way. My partner is far better at cooking than I.
Yeah, likewise, my wife is infinitely better than me. But I give it a go. Like anything, I'll give it a go, especially if I can remember and honour my mum or my dad in the process.
Yeah.
Which means a lot to me.
And I think it's really nice being able to hold that memory. You know, we can, I think when someone's death has been associated with cancer, it's really important to remember that stuff. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So your mum lives here, and which is below my T-shirt, which I love my T-shirt. I just wanted to say, mum's in my heart, and my mum would be horrified that I'm wearing a T-shirt that's got a rude F-word on it, but I'd like my mum to not see that F-word and see that I'm fighting cancer, and yes. I live each day to fight cancer, as she tried to do and so many people try and do. So you can read whatever F you want into it, but I honestly think, if cancer, because I really hate cancer.
Me too. I've actually got behind me, you probably can't see it, but this plate here says if cancer on it.
So. Yes, we're in solidarity. And I'm sure many people feel that way. No one likes cancer. We all want it to F off.
Yeah, absolutely.
And COVID as well, because it's causing havoc around the world.
Yeah, that can F off too, thanks.
Yeah, that's right. Just let us live in peace and harmony and goodwill.
Exactly.
Because that's what we want to do.
Hey, well, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's, I feel really humbled to be able to have that insight into how cancer has affected you.
It's all right. I always feel like crying when I talk about my mum, so I'll probably go now and have a big blubber. But, that just means that I'm still human and I'm very much alive. And, yeah, and I always want to remember my parents, so that's cool. So thank you for allowing me this opportunity.
The C Word Kiwis Talk About Cancer is every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and anytime at planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word. Thanks for joining me and I'll see you next time.
You like a bird on the wire, like a drum in a midnight choir. I have tried in my way to be free, like a fish on a hook, like a knife from some old-fashioned book. I have saved all my river for thee. If I let it go by. If I have been untrue, I hope you know it was never to you. Like a bird, like a baby still born, like a beast with his horn.
she can get away. Know that you can't hide it from yourself. You can't get away. You know that you can't hide it from yourself.
Got the acclaim. judge. How to dance, you must have took a while. My interest is being aroused by your perpetual motion. My approach is not in the least concerned with highbrow notions. You got the name, you got the style, but you got a sense of fashion underneath that cool facade. Sense of fashion, the man who touch her, how to dance, he had a sense of style. The man who touch her, how to dance, he walked the royal mansions. The man who touch her, how to dance, he walked the royal mile uphill, on his knees, through his teeth, on his nose, on his nose, on his nose, on his nose. Touch her, how to dance, to come from cha-cha, boogie the gander, the key. Eat an elbow. Oh! From the body swirl. Give him 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 the rubber ear. Give him the rubber ear. Give him the body swirl. Body sweat, the body sweat.